On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss takeaways from the New York State Association of Ambulatory Surgery Centers Fall Conference in Tarrytown, New York, on November 6th and 7th. We review nursing retention and development with Ann Geyer, Donna Macchio, and Wendy Dixon, and discuss starting a total joint program with Jeffrey Thomas and Michael Falth of IMSS.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 75 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for November 18th, 2019, recording from the New York State Association of Ambulatory Surgery Centers Fall Conference in Tarrytown, New York, and from our studio in Spenceport, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics. So here we are back in freezing cold Rochester again.
Yeah, wow. Big difference. We saw it as we were coming up the thruway from the, actually, we drove into a snowstorm when we came back from the conference. Yeah. But that was actually more than a week ago, so we're recording this episode a little bit late. By the way, did you notice that this is episode 75, another milestone in our recording history?
I think I just actually said that.
Yes, you did.
A moment ago. Although it doesn't always make that connect.
I know.
Saying it and hearing it.
Well, and of course, as we're sitting around this studio, and people are probably getting tired of hearing us talk about our wonderful new studio here, we have jury-rigged equipment because I decided to do some upgrades on the computer equipment that's in the studio here, and in the process broke the main computer that does all the recording. So we're using a backup computer and a kind of a jury-rig system here. So I don't know. This whole new studio is becoming a bit of a jinx here, I'm afraid. So anyway, I've got that computer upstairs. I'm still working on it, Sue. Hopefully we'll be back to normal soon. But so I think the conference in Tarrytown went wonderfully. Mm-hmm. It was probably one of the best programs that I've seen. And we did do a special episode number 74, which we recorded just before this, where we had the leadership of the State Association discuss, you know, various things that are going on that are kind of only pertinent to New York State Association members specific. or New York State ASCs. So for this episode, I thought we would, you know, talk about a couple things that were discussed during the conference. And we did actually three interviews during the conference that'll be applicable to the wider audience nationally. One, we talked to IMSS about developing a total joint program. Mm-hmm. We had a wonderful conversation with three nurses, Ann Geyer, Donna Macchio, and Wendy Dixon. Ann, of course, is with SIS. Donna Macchio is the administrator at Ambulatory Surgery Center of Westchester and a very good friend of mine and a client. Wendy Dixon, also a very good friend of mine. She's the administrator at Mohawk Valley Endoscopy Center. And they did a wonderful session at the conference, and we were able to record them just before they actually did that conference, that session.
They're great, very knowledgeable nurse leaders, so that would have been a great session to see.
It was. Well, you got to edit it anyway.
I did, so I've heard it.
We also interviewed Nelson Gomes while we were down there, my dear friend, and we did a separate interview related to cybersecurity. We were trying to do an episode for Cybersecurity Month, which was October, and Unfortunately, we're not able to get it in beforehand. We were close. So we're going to do a separate episode later in this month on cybersecurity. And while we were there, we also had this wonderful dinner with our clients at the hotel, the DoubleTree. So it was wonderful to see. We had two tables there. I mean, there were a lot of people.
Two big tables. Yeah. Yes, we kind of overwhelmed the restaurant, but we did get our food finally, it was very good, and we enjoyed socializing with everybody.
I think Alex started by saying we had six people, then he doubled it, and then he doubled it again, because I think by the time we were done, we had almost 20 people there.
Yeah, John and I were at the registration desk, so we're just watching people keep walking by, like, we're going to dinner with John, we're going to dinner, so I'm like, well, we're coming too.
It was it was a wonder. It's great to be able to sit down in more of a social occasion, and of course, let our clients interact with each other too, so that was a lot of fun. And I'm glad we had that opportunity to get our clients together down there. Yeah. So, Sue, I thought we would talk about we've had some questions recently related to C-arms in the ambulatory surgery setting. Mm-hmm. And I thought it might be appropriate to mention in this section some of the issues that tend to come up during surveys.
For anybody that has the C-arms, they know they're monitoring the exposure of the employees with the badges. So you want to make sure that when those dosimetry reports come in, that you'll receive those back quarterly. You want to make sure that the physicist or a physician with knowledge of radiology or that's in charge of the radiology program takes a look at those, reviews them, and then signs them. The reports should also be available to the employee. And you want to follow up and document the follow-up on any unusual readings that you might see.
And this is particularly important with those employees that work in multiple places, which is actually quite frequent when you have per diem.
That they keep track of their own numbers and sort of add them together and make sure that they're still okay.
And if there's any questions, then, you know, work with the physicist or work with the physician to try to determine whether any additional intervention has to occur. You know, a number of years ago, I had a doctor in one of the surgery centers that had relatively high levels. It wasn't dangerous, but they were levels that really shouldn't occur. Yeah. And based upon those reviews and based upon discussions with him, and also he compared it to the other places he was working, they decided to put a lead shield in. In other words, so he would actually stand behind this this lead shield, or leaded window shield, I should say, which greatly reduced the amount of exposure that he had. So again, very important that you document it and include those reports in your binders for radiology and make sure that a surveyor is able to see them. Second, we want to make sure that the annual physicist inspection is done, you know, within a year after the previous one, or more frequently if you're using that equipment, you know, frequently, and that report is available on a timely basis and put into the binder. That's an issue that tends to pop up every once in a while where people can't find that report, and it's extremely critical, and it should be included in the radiology binder.
Weekly QI testing must be performed as per the manufacturer's instructions, so make sure you're doing that.
Right. So again, we also often talk about instructions for use, and that applies to everything in the organization. That's something you're going to find surveyors really hammering on now is what, you know, we call them IFUs. Every piece of equipment and every supply that you have that you use, you should have instructions for use. And of course, if it is a drug or material or fluids that have a safety data sheet or a drug that have a safety data sheet, of course, you have to maintain those in a separate binder also.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people get so used to doing a certain procedure or using a type of equipment, and then if they switch it out, they just sort of keep going with the same technique. And it's just important to make sure you read those instructions and make sure you re-educate your staff.
I think this is kind of obvious, but a log has to be maintained of all the uses of the equipment, you know, the names of the patients and the levels that were used on that patient. And then lastly, certainly not lastly in terms of all the things that need to be done in a radiology program, but in terms of the types of issues that we tend to see in the radiology services, that the in-service records demonstrated in the annual training, or more frequently if necessary, of the staff must be, again, put into the training book or the radiology manual and must be available for a surveyor. So those are just some helpful hints. And one of the reasons that we're bringing this up is because in the state of New York, the state went out and hired a slew of new surveyors. And they're going around now, and their goal is to do annual surveys of this. And they are much more comprehensive than they were in the past. Now, I know other states are already doing this, but I thought it might be very important that we remember all of the things that need to be done in a well-run radiology program. So let's take a short break, and we'll come back with two interviews. now that CMS is starting to reimburse for total joint programs in the ASC setting, we thought it might be a good idea to discuss some of the challenges setting up a program. So we're able to interview Jeffrey Thomas and Michael Felth with IMSS. So let's listen.
This is John Gailey here. I'm at the New York State Association meeting, and I have the pleasure of having with me Jeffrey Thomas and Michael Felth from IMMS. Welcome.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
Thank you.
So we thought we would talk today a little bit about the CMS just recently came out with the addition of some total joints, some new total joint codes. We know this is the beginning of a lot of this. So we thought it might be an interesting discussion to talk about, you know, what the impact is going to be, how you start up a total joint program, you know, what types of things you need to do to get prepared for it. So go for it.
Yeah, so it's interesting. We've seen this transition coming for a little while, and now that it's actually upon us, it's how do we implement this into the surgery centers? And so a lot of things to take into consideration. Obviously, patient selection criteria is going to be ultimately what drives what's going to the surgery center versus what's going to the hospital. But the surgery centers have a lot of things to put in place to make sure they're prepared. There's a lot of equipment typically that's associated with total joint surgeries. It's working with those total joint companies to see how you can minimize the amount of sets that you have, the amount of space that you're taking up. It's also critical and leading up to the approval from CMS, the debate back and forth between the hospitals and the surgery center was that criteria of how do you care for that patient if something goes poorly. And Mike brings kind of a unique perspective because he's been on the administrative side of things in preparation for all of this as well.
Yeah. Thanks for having us, John. As an administrator in Rochester, New York.
At one of my former centers, by the way.
Absolutely. As a former administrator, we definitely saw the need. Rochester is typically a conservative city, but places like Buffalo, Utica have been doing this kind of thing for time now. And, you know, we weren't trying to reinvent the wheel. We spent a fair amount of time going to conferences and different surgery centers in Buffalo. Excelsior is one of them. And definitely saw the path for a successful outpatient total joint program. So we brought some of their expertise over to Rochester, and he did some beta testing at one of the local hospitals with kind of a fusion of their patient selection criteria and one that we developed with our anesthesia department and a couple orthopedic surgeons, and found very quickly that it works. It works very well. The biggest thing to take into consideration, as Jeff said, was the patient selection criteria and the motivation on the patient's part to want to get up right away and go home. So it is exciting to see that CMS has adopted a code for total knee arthroplasty for outpatient settings. And I hope to see that in the very near future, it's the total joints, you know, in Rochester.
And so, you know, I have a unique perspective because I work in many states. And, you know, in Ohio, for example, we've been doing total joints for a couple of years. It's always disappointing to me that in our own state, New York, is very difficult to get it up and running. But when we started the program in Ohio, you know, we were fully prepared for that patient to stick around for a long time. And we had been kind of warned that that might not be the case, that there is, you know, good pain management now. And that you mentioned earlier, that motivation to get out. I mean, they don't want to stay too late. They want to get home. They want to watch TV. You know, they want to, you know, have a meal with their family. So talk a little bit about it. Those are the types of things that you have to be prepared for. What was the big surprise that you had when you visited, you know, some organizations that were doing it already?
You know, the biggest thing that I think we saw was the ability for the anesthesia team to develop those preoperative cocktails that made it possible for the patient to feel comfortable enough to go home. I think as much as you warn folks preoperatively about what it's going to feel like, it's a different story after the surgery. And, you know, I think we were surprised at what we initially thought from our anesthesia department would be an appropriate cocktail, so to speak, versus what we saw in Buffalo. And we learned some things. I'm not an anesthesiologist, but we definitely took away a couple of things from them and adopted those in our beta testing at the hospital, and it seemed to pay some dividends.
Patient selection is the biggest driver here. You know, you've got to be very careful of choosing somebody that is, as we talk about, being motivated to go home right away, that understands that they're in an outpatient setting, and of course has a good history and physical that demonstrates that they're a healthy patient, or if they're not a healthy patient, we've prepared for, you know, whatever contingencies we have there. So you got to have a good plan in place. So do we just jump into this? Do we just like, you know, call you guys up in the morning and say, you know, can you bring the equipment out in the afternoon and we'll be able to do surgery by late afternoon? What do you think?
No, I think it's like any other process that you're implementing for the first time. I think that you start slow and then ramp up. You have to realize that a lot of these staff that have been in the surgery center as well probably have not been doing total joints in quite some time. So it's getting your team acclimated. It's making sure that all your processes are in place. It's making sure that you can manage the flow, as Mike talked about. And it's critical, as Mike said as well, that, you know, the direct communication with anesthesia, because ultimately this is the goal of this, is to take these low risk patients into the center that can get out within that 23 hours.
You know, speaking as a vendor, obviously we have to rely on the vendor to help us through this process. Talk us through the time frame for implementing such a program and what types of resource you're going to have to bear, like how many meetings are you going to have, who you're going to work with in the surgery center to prepare for this.
Yeah, it's very multifaceted, and I can tell you the talks are already going on with a lot of the total joint companies where physicians are talking about driving all this into the surgery center. And so from a vendor perspective, it's working with the central sterile department, making sure what their capabilities are, that they can handle the excess equipment that's coming in, because again, these are sets that weigh much more than what they're accustomed to. Most vendors now have gone to two set systems to reduce the amount of inventory that you have to have, which helps tremendously. But you also, in addition to the central sterile department, the vendors are working directly with the nursing staff. They're working with the physicians. They're planning a lot of these cases out in advance, so there's no surprises. They're making sure that all the implants, again, there's a large number of implants that go with total joints. So as much as you can streamline that and minimize it by preparing for those cases ahead of time, whether it's templating with your physician and minimizing how much you're disrupting the daily flow, because there's still a lot of other cases other than total joints going on in these centers. But I think we will see more and more joint-specific surgery centers popping up in New York State now that this has got the CMS approval.
How long do you think it would take to set up a program in an ASC?
Well, the biggest thing is coming up with the training for the physicians, the anesthesiologists, the staff, writing a program and policy to dictate how you're going to do total joints in an outpatient setting. So, you know, typically in an inpatient setting, you have a program set up so that you have classes to go to and learn about what to expect. That exists in the outpatient setting too. So, you know, I would say a fair amount of time to give yourself would be anywhere from 6 months to a year, because there's so much that goes into it and you want to do it the right way. You know, obviously, paramount in all this is patient safety. And I think anybody who rolls out a program like this is thinking that way. One of the things, not to backtrack too much, but one of the things that we did when trying to implement the total joint program in the surgery center that I was an administrator at was during the beta testing, we also were toying with the idea of not discharging patients at the surgery center directly home. We were kind of going to have like a step down unit. We looked at, you know, buying a condo or having a hotel room or somewhere where we could actually have the patient go for the night with a family member and we could pay a nurse or a nursing service to be there to answer questions or to kind of be a buffer for them. Because, you know, it's a big transition to do smaller cases to a big case like that. And, you know, our line of thinking was, why not? Why not have the ability to spend 6 months and kind of tinkering with what works, what doesn't work before we're actually prepared to discharge a patient directly home.
And you mentioned earlier, too, the importance of sterile processing, getting sterile processing involved. Of course, I did a session earlier today at the New York State Association Conference here where we were talking about how surveyors are getting a lot tougher, and then infection control, sterile processing is the area that they're focusing on a lot more. This isn't just something you walk in and hand the instruments to the sterile processing people and say, hey, take care of these things. They got to have all the information. They got to make sure that they have the proper equipment to do the sterilization. They have the IFUs, the instructions for use, so they're prepared for it. They go through the training. You represent vendors. Obviously, there's going to be some very specific training from you with those individuals on how to prepare for it. So any quick thoughts about that as we end?
Yeah, exactly as you said, John. I mean, there's a lot of things in play here, and it can be overwhelming for Central Sterile, who already has a critical role in these facilities. And now you're adding a whole additional layer And again, if you're doing multiple joints in one day, it's probably not feasible to have six or seven sets like you may at a hospital. So it's working with them, making sure they're comfortable, training them, and also making sure the staff's involved so that if you're at a point in that procedure where maybe you can pull a couple of sets and help them transition and start getting ready for maybe that third case of the day, you minimize the impact on them so it's as smooth as possible.
Thank you so much.
And next, John spoke with Ann Geyer with SIS, Donna Macchio, the administrator for the Ambulatory Surgery Center of Westchester, and Wendy Dixon, the administrator of Mohawk Valley Endoscopy Center, about all the challenges that ASCs face in retaining nurses, bringing in new nurses, training new grads to work in an ASC setting, and building and encouraging nurses to become leaders.
So this is John Gailey. I'm here at the New York State Association meeting in Tarrytown, and I have the pleasure of having three nurses in front of me who are going to be talking about the subject of recruitment and retention. I have Ann Geyer from SIS, I have Wendy Dixon from Mohawk Valley Endoscopy, and I have Donna Macchio from the Ambulatory Surgery Center in Westchester. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you're about to do a presentation. I should be catching you before the presentation. So why don't you give me a little bit of introduction as to, you know, what you want to talk about and what do you feel is the best way to approach this topic?
All administrators of ASCs are struggling right now with nursing recruitment and retention. There's a shortage of nurses that seems to be getting worse and worse. And previously, the trend was you would never hire a new grad into an ASC setting because you needed someone who had the basic skills that they had developed in a hospital setting of assessment skills and organizational skills. And now a lot of administrators are finding that they don't have that option, that they're having to look to new grads as well because of the shortage. So we're hoping to give some hints as far as orientation and mentoring and how to make that as successful as possible for the administrators.
And the one field that's particularly difficult is operating room nursing, because you can't just come out of nursing school and walk into an OR. And AORN offers the Periop 101 course, but a lot of centers can't afford to send their nurses, their new nurses, through that course. So they're having to be creative. And one of the ways they're creative is they partner with nursing schools. If you're lucky enough to have one in your area, let them come in as interns and or do their clinicals at your center where they get to see what you're actually doing, because ASCs are not easy to work in. They're not laid back places. They're not slow paced. And some new grads would just freak out in that environment.
And from our standpoint, it takes about a full year to really orient somebody to the operating room. And physicians come to an ASC for the efficiency and for the speed of getting through their cases. And they are not always interested in slowing down the pace enough for a new grad to really learn and be comfortable in that environment to truly learn what it is like to work in an OR.
I think one of the things that we find is that in the past, there's always been this paradigm where we feel it's important to hire people with a lot of experience in the operating room, for example, or in post-op in the PACU area. And unfortunately, we can't really do that anymore. We can't rely on that. Talk a little bit about, you know, what challenges do you have when you're taking some of these new nurses out of school?
It takes a lot of time, as you just heard, to train someone, but not everybody is a good trainer. I think one of the main things to consider is who on your staff is a good mentor preceptor. They are not created equal. And if you don't pair them up with the right person who's got the same dedication and the same goals and objectives as you do for this doing the hiring, then it's not going to work. And the new person isn't going to learn, and the preceptor gets frustrated, and it's a disaster. That preceptor also has to be a liaison, introducing the surgeon to the new person and saying, Ann's in your room today, she's new to our facility, but I'm going to be right here. That's where they don't lose that efficiency that you just talked about. If you put the new nurse in there because she's a nurse and you figure she can muddle through it, that's when the doctors get upset. Next thing you know, they're yelling at the new nurse. You've just lost her.
And along with that, when you're speaking to preceptors and with physicians as well, there is a very different way of teaching or precepting different generations of nurses. And when the average OR nurse is mid-50s or older, and when you're bringing in a new nurse who's in her early 20s, there's a very different way of teaching and learning, and that can also be a huge barrier to a successful orientation.
It's important, you know, we talked about how important it is to select the right mentor, but back to the hiring process, it's very important also to select the right candidate. Again, not all are created equal and not all are a good fit for an OR setting. You need someone who has that self-assurance to deal with physicians. Again, that nurse has to be the patient advocate. And if you hire someone who's too timid to do that, especially as a new nurse, that can really create a danger for your patients. They have to be able to advocate and stand up for the patient.
Talk a little bit about that, you know, the nursing advocacy side and the importance of finding somebody that's willing to stand up, willing and able to stand up to a doctor.
That starts at the top. The person doing the hiring, usually the administrator or executive director, has to put as part of their expectations, my expectation is I will give you all the tools to do this job to the best of your ability, and I'm empowering you to speak up when something is not right, and I will have your back. And I think that I've told some stories in my last talk where I had bosses that didn't have my back and threw me under the bus. And if you do that, I lasted maybe 2 or 3 more months in that job. I thought, I don't need this. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that. So set the expectations high, but then demonstrate that you will have their back, that you're empowering them. If you get into a confrontation with the doctor, that I will back you up. And when you've done that, you've got an ally now with this new nurse. And I think one of the mistakes that I find in hiring, as you were talking about that a minute ago, is people are so panicked when they need a nurse in whatever field, they'll hire a body,
right. Just
about any body to fill that job. Now they've got a bigger problem because that person doesn't work out. Now you've got all the performance issues you have to deal with. So sometimes you have to wait a little while and you have to it's hard on everybody, but you wait and you get the right fit. They have to culturally fit your center. But it's a best case scenario when you take a new grad and you can mold her into the nurse that you want, because all of a sudden you've got a happy nurse, you've got a happy team, and you can take pride in that.
I always feel that's one of the, when you're dealing with a younger nurse, sometimes it's easier because you don't have to untrain them from the past habits.
You can train them the way you want them.
Right.
This conversation also lends itself to retention. You know, the better job you do at retaining the nurses you have, the less recruiting and the less training you have to do. And everyone understands how expensive it is to train and orient a new nurse. So some of it is really paying attention to the culture at your center and having their back so that your staff trust you and they trust that you're going to watch out for them and advocate for them. But also having that culture between the staff so that it's a pleasant, enjoyable work environment. And I've actually been able to use that to help recruit nurses. All nurses have friends who are nurses. And if they enjoy their work, if they like their boss, if they like the people they work for and work with, then they're going to tell their friends, you know what, why are you miserable there? Come on over here. We're looking for somebody and this is a great place to work. And that's your best recruiting tool.
That is your best tool.
Yeah.
I wish actually this was a video, because if you look at us all talking, I mean, it's obvious, by the way, you're all very passionate. Thank you for having a chance to talk about it. I told a very quick story this morning where one of our clients, has an administrator that's a little bit on the weak side, a nurse manager. And I've spent a lot of time there and I've looked at this other nurse who's kind of in the background, who is fantastic. She's always she's clearly interested in quality improvement. She's passionate. I can see she's passionate. She's always got the right answers. And I went to the owner and I said, you know, why isn't she the nurse manager? Why is this other one who's a bit on the weak side? He said to me, well, she's my best IV nurse. She's the only one that can start an IV. So what's the point behind that? I mean, right. I mean, those are the people you want to manage, because they're the ones that can now, if she's the best, then she probably can teach somebody those skills. What do you think about that?
I think it is very difficult for owners, even myself as an administrator, when you have a very strong clinical person, you're always tempted with not moving them to a different position because you so need their clinical expertise in that area. However, I think that that lends itself to the whole retention. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to allow that person to move up, somebody else will. Somebody else will recognize that person has more skills than you're using, and you're going to lose them to go somewhere else. So I think that you have to really always focus on the fact that, you know, hands-on skills, starting an IV can be taught, but there are certain parts of nursing leadership that really can't be taught, that you either have that personality that lends itself to that or you don't. If you have a very timid nurse, she may be great as a hands-on caregiver. She may not ever be able to stand up to a physician and say, you're being disruptive and you can't behave that way in my OR. So I think you have to always make sure that you're focusing on the person's skill set and how you can most effectively utilize that, whether it's convenient for you or not.
As leaders, I think we always need to have our eyes and ears open, just like you did. You've identified someone that's in the background but demonstrates leadership qualities. You can't teach someone that, you can teach IV skills like that nurse had, but if they've never demonstrated anything but that, that's probably all they'll ever do. But the ones who have that potential, then we need to groom them. Mm-hmm. And people say to me all the time, but why do you want them to go back to school? Or why do you want them to learn this, 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 and this, get to pass their CAPE exam? Mm-hmm. And I'll say, because they're bright enough, they love to learn, you can tell. And then they'll say, but you'll lose them. And I said, that's a risk I take, but I'm gonna lose them anyway, because they're gonna become bored and they'll see this as a dead end job and they're gonna move on. So now you've lost them for retention purposes.
Right. You need it to promote their capabilities and allow them to make the most of themselves. And that's going to make a happy employee.
Yeah, all three of us love to learn. And when that goes away, then we get stale. Right. And the staff knows we're stale if we're not learning. And it's the same thing for the staff. We owe it to them to keep them sharp, to keep them integrated into what we're doing. You can't teach motivation. We all have nurses that are never going to be motivated. Do they do their job? Yes, but they're only meeting expectations. They're never going to exceed. So then you have to stop and say, okay, this isn't going to be the person, but they're a good nurse. You don't want to lose them. But I have Susie over here that she's going to knock it out of the ballpark. Invest your time in that kind of person.
So I'm going to put poor Donna on the spot. Donna's a client of ours, and she's in the middle of, she has a new nurse manager coming on board. A lot of experience, mm-hmm. not a lot of experience in the ASC area. And, of course, you and I have talked by email, but not in person, mm-hmm. about one of the plans we have, which is to very purposefully put together an education program or a mentoring program for that. And we actually said it's going to be in writing. It's going to be very specific. I'm putting you on the spot because we haven't talked about how we're going to do that. And I think we're kind of almost brainstorming right now. But talk a little bit about what your thoughts are there.
So my first thought, what I've done with this gentleman, is coming in as my new clinical supervisor, I think the first thing that he needs to do is gain the respect of our clinical staff. So the first place I've put him is on the clinical unit. He is working side by side in my pre-op area and in my operating room with my staff and working with my charge nurse, walking the walk and gaining their respect. And I think if he can do that, then we can bring him to the point where we can really start mentoring him in some of the administrative parts of leadership. If he can't gain the respect of the staff, then there's no point in moving on to that second step. I'm confident that he can, and he's very willing to do that. And so far it's been great, and I've heard a lot of very good things about him. But I then need to sit down with him, and we need to come up with a plan to teach him, the conditions of coverage and the CMS rules and regs. And he has already started reading through the AAAHC standards and has some really good ideas about it. We had our first QA meeting with him, and he had some great ideas for new QA PI projects, so I think that's very promising. But I think that we're going to need to focus him on what is specific to the ASC industry, because he has worked in an endoscopy center, but most of his experience is hospital-based.
I think identifying the person like we just talked about, and what you're doing, Donna, is just exactly what I would tell people to do. They have to earn the trust. And one way that you destroy that is if you hire someone from the outside to fill a management position and you never posted the job internally, mm-hmm. even if you thought you knew who you were going to hire, mm-hmm. if you never give your staff that opportunity, it doesn't matter how skilled that outside person is. They have 10 strikes against them as far as the staff is concerned, because they resent the fact that nobody was given that opportunity. That happened to me many, many, many years ago, and I didn't know that it happened. I came in from the outside, mm-hmm. and the staff wouldn't talk to me. It took 2 years for them to trust me because they felt like I was part of that game. So if you've got a position open for management, you've got to consider how you're going to handle it. But they do have to gain the support of the staff. And they need to learn not to say, at my other job, we did such and such, because that doesn't work. Nobody wants to hear that. Now, as an administrator, I used to say, if you know something that we're doing could be improved, please speak up. But I really encouraged that at staff meetings so that all the staff heard it. It wasn't a matter of this person saying, we did it better.
I always encourage when I do have new staff, though, I say a fresh set of eyes is so valuable.
Always.
So please bring suggestions to me. Bring me ideas of what you did. We'll talk about if it fits in this setting. But again, that fresh set of eyes, because you get blind to what you see every day. So take advantage of having that new person in the facility as well.
And they do have a lot to offer.
Absolutely.
One of the things I have found with new people, yes, I think it's a great thing to have a fresh set of eyes, but I've also had the nurse who comes in from another center who is more than just a fresh set of eyes, who points out, you're not doing that right, where I came from, we did blah, blah, blah. And that really wreaks havoc on any preceptor or any type of an orientation. It's great to share your experience and to offer different ways of doing things, as long as you're not pointing and saying you're doing this wrong.
Yeah.
People really take offense to that.
How they present it.
Absolutely.
And the ones that I was talking about are the ones that they're in a room in the OR and they're working with the staff, and every single thing that staff does, well, at my other center or at the hospital, and they just finally just tune this person out.
Right. And then you may miss what could be a really
good
suggestion.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to actually listening to the real session.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
So I want to thank all the people that we had an opportunity to interview during the New York State Association meeting. Let's take a short break, and we'll come back and talk about upcoming events in the ASC industry. So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry.
Every episode, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com. Also want to remind you that the ASC podcast with John Gailey is available to support your ASC association, and John is available to speak, and we can also record a podcast from your meeting.
The AAHC Achieving Accreditation Conference is an interactive, in-depth, two-day seminar designed to help organizations prepare for a AAHC survey. The next conference is December 6th and 7th in wonderful Las Vegas. I'm going to be down there going through some retraining myself, and hopefully I'll see some of you there. And then after that, the next seminar will be March 13th and 14th in Miami.
And ASCA's 2020 Winter Seminar is in New Orleans, Louisiana, January 16th through the 18th. The seminar will feature three ASC-specific tracks, finance and accounting, coding and reimbursement, and ASC management. And John, you'll be speaking in the finance and accounting track.
And the AORN Global Surgical Conference is in Anaheim, California, March 28th through April 1st. We're finalizing some plans to be at the conference and recording a special episode there. And we do want to thank AORN for allowing us to attend.
The Iowa Association of ASC's 12th Annual Education Conference is April 17th and 18th in Johnston, Iowa.
ASCA 2020 is in Orlando, Florida, May 13th through the 16th, 2020. It is the ASC industry's most highly regarded and well-attended event. Attendees include physicians, administrators, nurses, managers, and owners of ASCs from across the country and throughout the world. At ASCA's annual conference, you will find more than 50 educational sessions designed for ASC professionals at every level, nationally recognized ASC management experts, networking opportunities with more than 1,000 of your colleagues, hundreds of exhibitors who can help you find the solutions your ASC is looking for, the latest regulatory and accreditation updates. Make sure you sign up to attend this very important conference. And of course, we're all going to be there and recording a special episode from there.
Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again, and please consider becoming a patron by going to our website at ascpodcast.com. And please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.